Welcome on, Senior.
Thank you, Teresa.
We're in show number 44, which is a great number in St. Louis. And we were talking last time about Shrewsbury, Webster, and Kirkwood, all right along that 44 road.
Right, that's right. There. We were,
Last time we were, I know you had said we were going to talk about balloon houses. That was the one of the things that stuck with me. I was like, but I don't know where you're starting, but I'm anxious to hear about the balloon houses.
We'll talk about that because that's what sociologists call a pull factor.
Okay.
You have a pull factor and a push factor. So why are you going to leave where you're living right now and go someplace else? There'll be things that'll be pulling you there, and one of those is a cheap, really good house on some really good, cheap land. And then
that's a pretty good pull factor.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, it really is. Before we do that, let's go ahead and talk about a couple other little parishes that are also opened up. First, let's say something about the census numbers.
Okay.
The city had a population of 816,000 people in 1940.
Wow.
Yeah. By 1960, 20 years later, it was 750,000. Now, that's a decline, but the reality is that I think most city people would wish they had 750,000 in it today.
In our city, would like to have that today.
Probably about half that. The other side of that is phenomenal growth in the county. In 1940, there were 274,000 people living in the entire county.
Wow.
20 years later, 703,000.
Wow. Okay, well, that number is a lot different than the number that left the city.
That's right.
But so we obviously have a huge growth in the general area.
Right.
Along with a big loss for the city.
Right. Okay. You know what that's called?
What?
Baby boomers.
Baby boomers. Absolutely. Yep. Right.
Yeah. 1940, you had a young man and a young woman. Mm-hmm. And by 20 years later, a middle-aged man and middle-aged woman and six or eight kids.
Yes. Exactly.
You also had other counties that were developing. And so in St. Charles, Jefferson, and Franklin counties, you're going to need more parishes there. In 1945, Immaculate Heart of Mary was founded in New Mellie. 1947, St. Bernadette in Morris Mills. In rural Jefferson County, there was a little village called Cottage Farm, and for a while it had its own parish, Little Flower. 1953, St. Gerard in Gerard, Missouri was founded. St. Sebastian was opened in Glen Owen, and Holy Rosary, big parish now, in Warrenton.
Oh, yeah.
That was established in 1956, same year that you had Our Lady in Festus, Our Lady's Parish in Festus is set up. And then Washington, of course, had St. Francis Borgia forever, but now it got a new parish too, Our Lady of Lourdes.
Oh,
and
yes.
That was in 1958. Yeah.
So that started with St. Gerald's and Gerald. Wow. Okay. Those are a lot of outlying parishes.
Yes.
That's the outside, still kind of the edge of what we think of the St. Louis area.
Yeah. Now, one thing I didn't do, and I'm remiss at that, is I didn't look out further into the state. You know, eventually Jefferson City is going to become its own diocese.
Yes.
But even before that, you still had growth taking place, and I didn't look into those parishes.
Okay.
In Volume 2, I did.
Right.
Volume 3, I really didn't.
We looked at that part of the country a little more.
So I'm remiss at that, and somebody might want to do that for a master's thesis somewhere.
There you go.
In 1961, in House Springs, St. Philomena, it was closed, but another parish took its place, and that was Our Lady Queen of Peace.
Okay.
O'Fallon got St. Barnabas. And I've often said that church was one of the ugliest churches I've ever seen. I think it was meant to be a gymnasium, and it's just kept as a church. Well, they have a pastor there now, and he has done a fantastic job. It is a beautiful church now.
I had never seen St. Barnabas, but I follow him. He did our marriage prep.
Really?
Yes.
At St. Monica's?
Yes, at St. Monica's.
Oh, nice.
Yes. And so
Father Ray Hager.
Father Ray, yes. And, and so I had seen pictures of it, and I'm like, that is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, there's no way that's what that looked like originally.
No.
So I had to scroll way back in his website to or his Facebook page to find the original pictures before he started. And, oh, man, what a phenomenal job with, you know, what was that, 63, 64 parish from that time. And really beautiful.
Yeah. I remember in the early 90s, I attended a funeral there. It was a priest or a deacon. I forget who had what the funeral was. But I remember going into that church, saying a prayer. I said, please don't send me here. And you know, I don't have the artistic ability that Father Hager
that
has.
Vision.
I could never have envisioned a church that beautiful.
I don't have that talent either, but I know he does. I know I've seen work that he's done in other parishes and beautiful.
Yeah,
and he
really
does.
Is.
I don't know how much of the church he's done himself, but I know he does.
Oh, he does
that
quite
himself.
A bit. Oh
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very impressive.
So in 1963, St. David's was founded in Arnold.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Down in Jefferson County. And then St. Robert Bellarmine was established out in St. Charles.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
63.
Yeah. So the easy answer to all of this is, why do you have so many Catholics moving to the county at this time? And the easy answer is white flight.
Okay.
Fleeing the city. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, when you start looking at the sociology behind all of this, it's much more complicated than that.
I would imagine it had to been.
It does. Yeah, it plays part of a role, but there's much more to it than that. So I wanted to find that out and look at that. And as we just said before, a lot of this growth is new human beings. It's the baby boomers,
right.
You know.
Right.
And here you can just see statistically how real this actually is. And, you know, and so you have men coming home after the Second World War. They either have been married or they're going to get hitched up with their girlfriends. They're going to get married. And then when they start looking around for a house, see, that's the other thing. There's not that much housing available in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of subdivisions being built in the county. There's been a lot of studies done on all of this, and there's some really great books I want to mention also that are just fascinating eye-openers. The interesting thing is that as you look at single-family units in the St. Louis area, it goes from 262,000 units in 1950 to 648,000 by 2000.
Wow.
Yeah. And wow. St. Charles County is even greater than that. So the county experiences during that period of time, that 50-year period of time, 147% growth.
Okay.
St. Charles experiences in that same period of time, 1,150% growth. Is that phenomenal?
That's almost uneven imaginable to me.
Yeah.
Just that kind of a growth.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean,
well, you know,
how do you even have enough people to build that much?
When I came back to St. Louis to study for the priesthood, the seminary wasn't ready for me, so I spent a summer out at All Saints in St. Peter's.
Okay.
And I attended some of the meetings with Father Chokel, who is the pastor there, and some of the other pastors, the deanery, in the deanery, they got together and they had these meetings, and they were literally trading off subdivisions, like as if they were playing Monopoly.
Oh, it's like, you know? I get this one. No, I get this one.
Yeah. Oh, no, they were happy to give them away to each other. Oh, yeah. It's
no,
just more responsibilities.
Right.
Yeah, that's happening. The fact of the matter is that as you get into the 20th century, there's a real, real draw for a single family dwellings.
Sure. I mean, we all want that. We all want to have our home with our little piece of land to raise our family.
Yeah, that's it.
Sure.
Yeah. And it just becomes a real American thing. Now, that's not true in the East Coast, and it's not true in Europe. But, boy, here, and especially in the Midwest.
Well, I was going to say, we're the Midwest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a real, real strong sense of that. There are even stylized homes that are developed in the early to mid-20th century. So you had, for instance, Cape Cod homes.
Right.
You know, colonial, ranch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so as I'm a kid in grade school, we lived in a ranch home in Olivet.
Yes, which has a lot of ranch homes
that
area.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Very, very popular. When I was in high school, we moved to Creve Coeur because Olivet was too congested for my dad. So we ended up in a Cape Cod house, which was actually built about 30 years earlier than the ranch
than
style
the
house
ranch.
We had. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just crazy. Where I live right now is a great example of it, in University City.
Mm-hmm.
The area that All Saints is located in is called North Parkview. The real Parkview, which is further south, is on the corner of Skinker and Forest Park Parkway, mm-hmm. in that area there. That's an early 20th century subdivision.
Beautiful homes.
Gorgeous. Yeah, gorgeous homes. Notice that the streets are not straight. They're not grid.
No.
They curve.
You can get lost in there.
You can. Yeah.
Especially because there's gates around there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's already gates too. But a lot of those homes were built by architects. I mean, you know, these were very famous architects.
Yeah, they're not cookie-cutter houses.
No, not
they're
at all.
They're all unique.
Yeah. So what happens is that north of Del Mar, so we have this area that then is called North Parkview.
North Parkview, okay.
And North Parkview, and we talked about this earlier, had been a racetrack.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
right,
remember?
Right.
That's why you got East Gate and West Gate.
Right, that's
and,
right.
Yeah, and so finally when the developers came in and began building again, they did curved streets. And actually what they did was they did streets parallel to the River de Pere, which is on the north part of North Parkview. And then they realized that if they wanted to maximize the value of the property, then instead of putting in bungalows and even in putting in big old mansions like they had in Parkview, what they did was they began building three-story apartments.
Yes. And you're surrounded
by those.
I'm
surrounded by those. It's, yes. Yeah, that's right. And so it's a little bit more congested. You do have some freestanding single-family homes, but most of it is apartments.
However, it
like
works
that.
Out. Pretty well now for the college students.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who
Washington
are very
University
nearby
is,
at
yeah.
WashU.
Yeah, right. that's for sure. So when we're starting to look at homes that are being built a little bit further west in these areas that we talked about, Overland and Creve Coeur and Olivet, St. Anne, they're introducing this style called the balloon house.
Okay.
And what that means is this. This house is built around a frame structure made of 2x4s.
Okay.
So you've got carpenters go in, they lay a foundation or they put in a basement. Then they put in the walls. Mm-hmm. And you've seen houses built before.
Sure.
You know, 2x4 sections, each of them 16 inches apart. The study, I mean, this was done in Chicago in the late 19th century after the Chicago fire. They began experimenting with different ways of building. And what they found was that if you put the 2x4s 20 inches away, it was not strong enough.
Okay.
If you put them 10 inches away, it was too strong.
You're wasting
you didn't need
too much
it.
Money. Okay.
Yeah, you're wasting too much money, yeah. And so they came up with 16 inches. That's the key. Using 2x4s, they're held together with nails. Okay, and this sounds obviously pretty obvious, you know. And then you put the walls on it.
Mm-hmm.
You nail the walls onto it. And there you end up with this house, which is much cheaper than if you were to build a brick and mortar house.
Which is what the city houses are all plaster wall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, you can have a house built that's much less expensive.
And probably quicker to build?
Much quicker. Oh, yeah. Much, much quicker. Yeah. And so whole subdivisions can be put in. When I was a kid in Olivet, there was a whole subdivision with 99 houses put in all at once.
Wow.
And it was all done within a year or 2 years at the most. That just is replicated over and over and over again all over the place. Here's the other thing is cheap land. The fact of the matter is that a lot of those truck farms that had supplied the city with food for generations, when you get to the 20th century, and especially after the First World War, remember at the First World War, America fed the world.
Yes.
You know? And then when the war came to an end and Europeans began growing crops again, then American farmers went into a depression. They stayed in a depression while everyone else was prosperous in the 1920s. They never got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Depression comes along. They're still in terrible shape. World War II comes along. They're doing fine. War comes to an end, and a lot of these farming families go, this is it. I can't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in high school and lived in Creve Coeur, my next-door neighbor was 84 years old. He had inherited the farm when he was, I think, about 14 years old. His father was killed coming back from St. Louis in a buggy. There was an accident on the corner of Ledoux and Ballast Road.
Oh.
And some guy in an automobile went flying through that intersection, ran into him and killed him. And then so Mr. Dowster then inherited the farm. That farm, I was told, ran from basically Ballast Road to Lindbergh.
Okay. Wow.
Think about that. And just south of Olive all the way to Ladue.
Wow. He didn't hold out quite long enough.
He held out long enough.
Oh, he did.
Oh, okay. He did real well for himself.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, there comes a point in time when these farmers, and he's only one, all the county was full with these kind of farms, when they turned around and go, this is ridiculous. I'm not making any money. I'm losing money. I can sell this land, and I can really do well. And that's exactly what happened. Shrewsbury is another example of this. Earlier on, about 30 years earlier, Shrewsbury finds itself self-divided. And it had been a giant farm, and now it's got houses. And so it replicated time after time. So that's another pull factor. You've got cheap houses, but they're very good houses.
Yes.
And you've got cheap land. And it's very good land.
Yes.
You know, and so people can come together and they, realtors and construction companies, and they can go ahead and do this. And then that's going to be two very important factors. Now, added to that, you also have automobiles.
Yeah.
You know, after World War II, all those industries that had been used for war were now reverted back to building automobiles. Remember this, that you could not buy a new automobile throughout that war. So you're saving your money, you're saving your money, you're saving your money, and now all of a sudden the war's over, new cars are coming out, and you've got money to buy them. So that's another factor that becomes really important. And with that, you also are going to have new roads being built. And ultimately, in the 1950s, the interstate highway system is going to be put in. Now, the interesting thing here is, and I don't think this was done by accident, that those roads were paid for by a modest gasoline tax. So, I mean, you paid a little bit more for your gasoline, but a modest amount. But in the aggregate, over the long haul, there it is. On the other hand, if you took public transportation, every time you got onto that bus, every time you got onto that streetcar, you had to pay.
Right.
So you're paying full fare there. And so it's an unfair advantage. Mm-hmm. And it's another reason why here in the United States, we don't have the public transportation like they do in Europe.
Right.
Because we made that decision in the 1950s that we fell in love with our automobiles.
Our freedom in our automobiles.
Yeah. And that becomes it. So you even have the Interstate Highway Act of 1956. And that is going to set up the building of 42,000 miles of roads, interstate roads. And the whole idea was going to be to connect every American city that had a population of 50,000 or more. Every American city was going to be connected to every other city through this interstate highway system.
50,000 was the number.
Yeah, 50,000 was the number. Yeah. Now, one of the ways that President Eisenhower got Congress to go for this was he said it's actually a question of civil defense. And his argument was that if we end up with a nuclear war, that was the big talk in the 1950s, you know, if we end up with a nuclear war, it would give the American people a couple hours to get out of the cities and get out to the country where they'd be safe. If you believe that, I'll sell you a bridge. But it worked.
Right.
It worked. Yeah. So you had the road building industry. Trucking firms were all in favor of it. The automobile industry was all in favor of all of this.
Of course.
You know, what's going to stop it? So this is all part of that pull factor. You know, you're being pulled out into the county. Then the other thing then, too, is the whole question of retail.
Yes.
Because if all the stores are in the city, then you're going to have to drive from your new little bonanza land into the city to shop. Well, there was an individual, he's a vice president of Sears, as early as 1925, did a study. His name was Robert E. Wood. And he did a study and showed that motor vehicle registration in most American cities was expanding faster than cities were putting in public parking. And so his thought there is that there's going to come a point in time in which people are going to be driving in from these new suburbs. Now, this is 1925. He's talking about this. They're going to be driving in, and they can't find a place to park.
Right.
And they're going to get frustrated.
Right.
And so he goes to Sears, and he says, hey, why are we building all these buildings downtown? Let's move where the people are.
Okay.
And so that's exactly what happens. And one of the first examples of this actually is in Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh. A
man by the name of Jesse Clyde Nichols.
J.C. Nichols.
Do you know the name?
J.C. Nichols? Yes. In Kansas City.
Oh, really? Interesting. Very,
yeah. Well, the plaza.
Oh, that's exactly it. A country club plaza.
Oh, yeah. Right.
It's the first one.
Yes.
You know, as such. And, you know, Teresa, we're sitting just a couple blocks away from the first one that came in St. Louis.
Oh, really?
Hampton Village.
Hampton Village.
Yeah.
Okay. I still hear people talk about that being the big shopping center.
Yeah.
The first shopping center, the area.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So rather than go downtown and go to the different department stores, you'd have a big, well, now we call it a big box store, but right. It was a big attractive store, and then some other smaller ones around, kind of niche kind of things. And people would go. Now, notice if you go to Hampton Village, it's mostly parking lot, isn't it?
It is, certainly.
Yeah. And that's the key.
There's always a place to park, right?
There's always a place to park, yeah. And so this is happening. Again, I go back to my own residence in the Del Mar Loop. The Del Mar Loop area in University City was developed way, way early in the early 20th century. And what happened was that people would take the trolley, well, this was a streetcar, out from the city, and they would come out to University City for entertainment. Okay,
yeah.
So you had the racetrack, but they got rid of that. Right. And then you had Del Mar Gardens, which was actually an amusement park.
Right.
And you get away from that hot city for a while and do that. Or you could go ahead and then jump on another line that takes you all the way out to Creefcar Park.
Oh.
You know, so those
you
are
the lake out there. Is the
lake? The lake.
Lake
yeah,
is there.
The lake
okay.
is out there, yeah. And so it was called the Loop because the streetcar literally looped around and then headed back downtown.
Okay.
So they had a whole bunch of companies and retail stores that were set up right along the Del Mar area, and people would come out to shop and entertainment, shop, the whole works. Well, what happened was that in 1948, Famous Bar built a department store just on the border of Clayton and University City.
Okay.
It's still there today. It's on Forsyth. Now, Washington University owns it today. It's no longer a department store.
Okay.
But what happened there was you had a major department store, you had lots of good parking, and you could go in that department store, you could buy anything you wanted. Now, you could go downtown and do the same thing down there, but where are you going to park?
Mm-hmm.
You know? What happened was that Famous Bar then began attracting people away from the Del Mar Loop, and University City panicked. And what they did was they took housing north of the loop itself, and they bought up all of that and they put in parking there. It's still there today. It's right across the street from the library, University City Library. It's directly north of
that.
And so what that did was it stabilized retail in University City.
Okay.
Now, you can replicate this in other parts also. I remember as a kid, Wellston had a very vibrant area there, and I believe they also had a trolley. So you had all of these kind of things happening. Next time we're around, we'll take a look at the push factors.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but okay. The pull factors is you bring it together. You've got freestanding homes, okay. They're inexpensively made. The land is inexpensive because the farmers want to get out of the business.
Yes.
You know? They've got so much going on. Then you have the extended highway system.
Yes.
And then added to that, you've got the malls.
The stores are coming for the convenience.
And for the convenience, yeah, and the strip malls, too.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the roads, you take Page, Natural Bridge, Olive, Del Mar, all of those going east and west, and they all had little strip malls along the way, too.
Mm-hmm.
What is a strip mall? It's a bunch of little stores, but a parking lot. You had to have a parking lot with all of that. Those are the reasons why people are leaving the city. My family's a great example of that. My dad was raised in South St. Louis. My mom was raised in Baden. They get married. The war comes to an end. They didn't even think twice about moving to Baden or moving to South St. Louis. They immediately bought a home. Well, no, not immediately. They first moved to North St. Louis, had a little two-family flat there for a while. My father was transferred to Chicago. There he got some real acreage. It was a big rambling ranch-style house out in Elmhurst.
Oh, yeah.
And Elmhurst was really, really rural at the time. So he got bitten by the land bug. And so when we got back to St. Louis, he was not even thinking about the city, immediately out to Olivet. And he bought that house, that little bungalow, for $17,500. And we lived in that house for about 10 years, and then he sold it for considerably more than what bought, and then moved further west, and it was all part of that westward movement. So when I was doing this research, I wanted to understand how all of this came about, and there were just really fantastic books. And we could end with one, just mention one real fast?
Sure.
Okay. This one's called Crabgrass Frontier, The Suburbanization of the United States. It's written by Kenneth Jackson, came out in 1985, but it really helps to explain how the suburbs came about. And St. Louis is just a perfect example of that.
Wow. Well, that's great. Shall we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Sure enough. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Thank you so much, Monsignor.
Sure enough.